Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Dan, who usually is now the host for the radio show, and he's also been kind enough to come in and to do the teching for us today. And then we also have, as our guest for today, Carl Orzechowski, which for people who have been longtime listeners of Animal Voices, you will know that he is also a past host and producer of the show, and a past tech and news guy, and sort of the jack of all trades for AV for a number of years. And we're really glad to have him back, and I'm really glad to be back and be hosting again. We're going to be talking about Carl's film. He made a film. It's a pretty amazing documentary called Maximum Tolerated Dose about the vivisection industry. I'm going to get him to talk a little bit more about it, but it's just a real honor to have you here. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Lauren and Dan.
So you made a pretty incredible documentary. Can you tell us what it's about?
Sure. So Maximum Tolerated Dose is a film, like you said, about the vivisection industry, but trying to look at the issue from a different perspective than maybe has been looked at in film before. The film is really trying to look at the lives of people who have directly participated in the practice, and also the lives of animals who have directly been involved in either the breeding or the actual, you know, practices themselves that take place inside the lab, and how that industry has affected both their lives while they did that work or while they were subject to that work, and how it affected their lives afterwards as well.
Mm-hmm. So why vivisection? And maybe for people who don't know that word, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. So I think vivisection literally means something like the cutting open of live animals, but vivisection is often used as like a catch-all term to talk about animal experimentation, but not all animal experimentation is technically vivisection, if you take that definition literally. But essentially, I mean, I wanted to do... People have asked me if I did the documentary because I felt like there was some kind of like lack of attention to that issue in the movement, and I didn't do it because of that. It was really just because I was able to talk to a couple of different people who had been directly involved in the industry, one of whom was through the radio show when I interviewed Dr. John Pippin. This was back in 2010. And I'm not really sure why, but the question came up during the interview. I said, you know, you're trained as a doctor, like, did you ever have to participate in medical experiments? And he told me this really intense story about how he was a research cardiologist for a number of years and had his own dog laboratory where he designed research studies, experimented on dogs using radioactive tracers, euthanized them and cut open their chests and removed their hearts and sliced them into pieces. And this was at the same time that he had his own dogs that he was living with at home. And this was an incredible sort of ethical dilemma for him that he was really struggling to work through. And so as he told me this story, this was the second story that I had heard from someone who had been directly involved. And I had started to sort of make some short films at the time, and I just, you know, I wanted to do something a bit bigger, and it struck me as like a really big story. And so that was sort of how I ended up focusing on that issue. It wasn't because I thought the movement's not doing enough for those animals. It was more just like a personal, I feel like the subject came to me. I didn't go to it.
Mm. It seems like, I know for myself when doing the show and when we were doing it together though, that it really did seem like there was a lack of resources available in terms of trying to find, I mean, the film I think is unique because, you know, you have books like The Sacrifice and Linda Burke, who is featured in the film, but for the most part, this is a pretty locked down industry. It's really hard to gain access to information about it. And one of the things I think the film makes a contribution towards is it gives you more of an insider track.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that will probably be pretty important moving forward as well. One of the things I've talked about with a lot of folks who have seen the film is, you know, everybody wants to know how they can get involved. And it's not the same kind of, vivisection is not the same kind of industry as other animal industries. And I think having those insider folks, I think we need to make more space for people who have directly participated in that industry to be a part of the movement. I think that's really where the cultural shift around vivisection is going to happen.
Can you say more about that, how you think that it's different from other?
It's different in that it's not as consumer-driven. Like, it's not necessarily about supply and demand. I mean, a lot of animal research that gets funded through research grants is what's called basic research. So the difference between basic research and applied research in an academic context is that basic research is essentially knowledge for the sake of knowledge. You want to find out how the lungs of a frog work, not because that has some application to frogs or to humans or to anybody, but because you're just curious. You want to know, it contributes to, you know, the breadth of human knowledge, as they say. So that kind of stuff, it doesn't matter where we spend our dollars or how we interact with the industry as consumers. We can't even interact with that industry as consumers. So the changes that are going to happen within that have to, like, they necessarily have to happen from the inside. They can't happen from the outside. In my opinion, I know there's probably some difference of opinion about that, but.
So speaking with workers, maybe then is part strategic for you, that you think that they're actually, by opening up that space, the way that you talked about opening up space for people who have been involved in the industry to also be part of the movement or part of that cultural shift to, like, make room for them in the movement. Tell us a little bit about how you came to think about it that way and then how you went approaching it. You said you spoke with Pippin, but how did you meet the other people and develop the concept for the film?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I first got into animal rights stuff, I mean, it was through the radio show, through meeting folks like yourself, through being exposed to the work that you were doing and the kind of focus that Animal Voices had and still has. When I started being involved with the show, I mean, there was very much a sense of wanting to highlight workers' perspectives and wanting to value those as valuable from an activist perspective, because they give us a certain kind of knowledge that we don't have access to. And also because it helps to expand the movement to have a more intersectional approach. So that was really, I mean, before I got into animal rights stuff, like, that was really my introduction, was that kind of perspective. And Animal Voices was really instrumental to that. And when I interviewed John Pippin, I mean, it's kind of like it was meant to be, that it was through the radio show and it was through this thing that you and I had worked on together for a long time. And, you know, the people that I discovered afterwards, sort of things kind of happened really organically. I didn't, you know, take out personal ads in random newspapers and just hope that people would write to me. Like, it was, I don't know what they call it in the university, but it was like an opportunistic sample, you know, people
right,
would,
snowball sampling.
Yeah, it was like one person would introduce me to the next person and then they would say, oh yeah, and I know this other person and so on and so forth. So it's not a scientific sample of researchers or of lab workers, but there wasn't really a particular strategy for finding people. It was just whoever came to me and whoever I was able to find.
Did you ever feel overwhelmed by, I mean, the industry is huge. It's huge globally, but it's huge, I mean, in North America and Canada. Mm-hmm. And I know that you really wanted to do this topic justice, and you only have a couple of hours, you know, with a feature-length film like this. Was it a struggle to figure out how you were going to make your editorial choices or how you were going to give a rich enough picture? Was that something that you struggled with?
I mean, for people who have seen the film, I think they have that question, because there's a lot, and I'll be the first one to admit, there's a lot that's left out of the film. The film doesn't cover research alternatives. It doesn't cover scientific arguments. It's a very focused piece. It's really about the individual stories of a handful of workers who struggled ethically with what they were doing and subsequently left the industry. And it's also very focused on the individual stories of a handful of non-human animals who were research subjects. Anything else that was outside of that focus, and there was lots that fell outside of it, was just, I mean, it had to just disappear. But that being said, through those stories, I think, you know, people will get an overall sense of what the industry looks like. It's just not spelled out in statistics, or there aren't flashy graphic charts that come up and tell you about the industry. It's just, it's storytelling. I see the film as part of a storytelling medium. I think documentary is best when it focuses on storytelling as opposed to like teaching people in big quotes, like a lesson, mm-hmm. you know? And I think their stories tell us a lot about the industry that, you know, stats and figures and that sort of thing wouldn't tell us.
So you were pretty close to this material for a long time. I'm mm-hmm. wondering about your own story, like the things that really lodged in your chest and kind of the sorts of observations that you made and what it meant to bear witness and then also to create an art project that would move other people. Like what stayed with you? What has stayed with you most from making the film and some of those stories?
The biggest things that stayed with me were definitely the, you know, the aspects of the film that I filmed myself. So the film is kind of a mixture of, there's a lot of found footage, old archival material. There's also archival material that I received from the BUAV and a couple of other places where that sort of fills out some of the things visually. But there was a great deal of the film that was filmed, you know, on location by myself and a couple other people. And I mean, our investigative work in Laos when we were investigating monkey farming there obviously really stays, like every kind of investigative work that I've done has really stayed with me in a pretty profound way.
So what was it like?
Doing investigative work is weird because you can't have a break. Like there's no, I'm going to take a bathroom break and be myself again. You have to really, you step into a character while you're doing what you're doing and you have to do what you have to do to get the material that you have to get. So while we were, myself and a couple other people were doing this investigation, I was the lead investigator and was, you know, I was pretending to be an animal dealer. The story was that I needed some monkeys to supply for a film, and then those monkeys and then subsequent monkeys were going to be used in a laboratory. And the film aspect of that story allowed us to bring in cameras, you know, to convince people to let us bring in cameras and shoot very, very high quality footage of the places that we were able to visit. And the laboratory aspect of the story helped us to get evidence of what was being done. And that I, after that investigation, I also compiled a report for the BUAV that was then used in some international meetings that they were a part of about trapping and breeding and that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I don't like lying to people. I don't like leading people astray, and I don't like that aspect of it. But, you know, my accountability in those situations is not to them. It's to the animals that are stuck there.
Can you describe what you saw?
So in the sequence of the film that I'm talking about, it's the fourth sort of chapter in the film, and it essentially shows the life cycle of what a macaque monkey would go through from being trapped in the wild of Cambodia or Thailand or Malaysia, being bred in massive farms in Laos, and then being laundered, and monkeys are laundered essentially in China because there are rules about their import and export. They're sent to China and Vietnam where they're given, you know, new paperwork and new identities. And then there's, from those Chinese and Vietnamese companies, they're sent off to the West and increasingly to places like India where research is being outsourced. In the monkey farms, it's kind of like what you would see at any kind of factory farm. You know, you're talking about long buildings. They have cages on either side, and the cages are a standard size. For the monkeys, the cages were, I'm terrible at estimating sizes, but I would say maybe, you know, 15 feet cubed, you know, 15 feet in either direction. And they would probably hold, I don't know, 25 or 30 monkeys each. And the monkeys were, it depended on the farm. I personally visited three different farms, and those different farms had various states of care for those monkeys, but I mean, the one thing they all had in common was that those monkeys came from the wild. They were trapped for pennies, essentially, given to the trappers. They were put in those, you know, forced living conditions with other monkeys who may or may not have been a part of their original families or social structures. And then they were used for breeding, to create as many as possible in as little as time as possible. And then those groups would be separated, tagged, and you know, sent all over the world. So that's, and I mean, that's before they even get into a laboratory. So just being witness to that aspect of the industry, the breeding and the trapping aspect of it, added a new dimension for me, and I think it'll add a new dimension for people who watch it as well. There's also some footage from a dog breeding facility. I think when we think about animals in labs, a lot of the time we think of them in labs, you know, and we think of them maybe with some like cartoonish image of a vivisector over top with a scalpel and looking all evil, but that's not what their lives are like for the most part. You know, for the most part, their lives are like, they don't start where we think they start, and they don't really end where we think they end either.
Yeah, this is something that we've talked about on the show so much, and you and I have talked about so much, that when we think about animal practices, often we're focusing on the very sort of specific, really invasive, physical, gruesome torture stuff, which is, of course, incredibly important to talk about. But one of the things I appreciated so much about the film is you get, more depth into their lives, that are those procedures that are happening, of course, are terrible, and we should be talking about them, but they really don't constitute the bulk of their lives. And I'm wondering if you could talk more about that, the kind of conditions that they're in, and a snapshot of what their lives are like when they're not being experimented on, which is something that sounds like it really moved you, and it's something that really stayed with me so powerfully from the film, is not necessarily about those more traumatic procedural events, but the life outside of that.
Yeah, and I mean, the film doesn't show a lot of graphic footage. There's not a lot of those, like, intense, gory procedures are not really part of the film at all. You know, there may be a little bit here and there, but it's pretty restrained. And yeah, I mean, it depends on what kind of species, you know, you're asking about when you talk about, you know, describing the life of a particular animal in a laboratory. But I think the thing that all of them have in common is that their lives are reduced to an extremely confined space. You know, for macaque monkeys in a laboratory, you're usually talking a 2-foot by 2-foot by 2-foot stainless steel cage. When you consider the kind of lives that they have, and I mean, this is shown in the film, you know, you see them in the wild, and you see the kind of habitat that they exist in, naturally.
And the social interactions they have.
And when you imagine them taken from that and put into this other thing, I mean, to me, it doesn't really matter whether the experiments that they're going through are class E or class D or whatever, in terms of the pain and all of that stuff, however the universities want to classify them. Their lives are abject captivity and misery. And like, these are places that are, they make even the worst roadside zoo look like Disneyland. I mean, it's not that the labs are not clean, or that they're not, you know, they get food when they're supposed to get food and all of that stuff. There's laboratory spaces heavily regulated, but that being said, the conditions in which they live are just so miserable that it's hard to imagine wishing that on your worst enemy. You know, it's worse than solitary confinement. It's as bad as you can imagine it to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that comes through in the film. And I think that's one of the things that really, I think the thing that has stayed with the non-humans who you meet in the film, who have been in the industry and who have been used by the industry, I don't think it's the particular procedures that really stay with them. It's the confinement and the captivity and the really intense sort of deprivations, sensory deprivation, social deprivation. It's those things that they have to struggle to heal from. The physical scars of a particular procedure heal relatively quickly, But the psychological scars are the things that really stay with them for really the rest of their lives. I mean, they're never, it's hard to see how they're ever normal again.
Yeah, I think that just, it opens up and I think deepens this debate around vivisection so much more, because to even entertain that they have a psychology or emotional lives or social lives, I think for a lot of people, for even people who are concerned about animal treatment, it's just not on the radar in the same way.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, laboratory spaces all over the world are regulated to include a certain amount of enrichment, or what people call enrichment. And I think that that word is incredibly misused as well when we talk about what's there to help make their lives, supposedly make their lives more manageable in the laboratory space, or more, I mean, I don't know, what's, like, enjoyable isn't the right word. You know, if a macaque monkey gets a little piece of a forage board that has sunflower seeds that they can pick at, but they're still in a 2-foot by 2-foot by 2-foot box, that's what the law requires, in the U.S. at least, and it's hard to see how that's enriching anything. I mean, it's a nice idea, but is it helping them at all? Is it keeping them sane? Is it, I mean,
I think, I mean, something like that, it's interesting, because enrichment, such a positive sounding idea. I think in some ways, though, what the you're talking about, this, the forage board and that kind of thing, speaks to where we're at maybe culturally in terms of dominant society about how we think about who animals are and what they deserve, right?
We're not willing to, I know I'm speaking in generalizations, but in terms of that industry, it really seems like we're willing to acknowledge that we feel like we have to use animals because we think they're enough like us that we may learn something, but we're not willing to admit, I know this is a very tired old adage in terms of animal rights stuff, but we're not willing to admit that they're enough like us that they deserve the slightest level. I mean, what's called enrichment is an insult, and we're not willing to really reckon with what, say, a macaque monkey or a beagle dog or a little white rat that's been purpose-bred for decades to be a laboratory animal, what those individuals need in terms of a social life, in terms of comfort, in terms of a psychologically healthy atmosphere. And I think if we were to really reckon with that, laboratories wouldn't exist anymore, because it's, without putting too fine a point on it, I mean, it's forced incarceration without consent, and it's hard to imagine being able to justify that if we really were going to reckon with what they need in their lives.
Yeah. We've been mostly discussing macaques, although you did mention some other animals. I think in some ways, I find this in my classes as well, that people are much more inclined to be open perhaps to thinking about stopping vivisection for non-human primates, but maybe less inclined or maybe less empathetic towards animals who aren't primates. But, of course, in the film, you talk about other animals as well. Maybe you could say more about how you tried to feature their emotional lives and their kind of psychological landscapes as well.
Sure. I really wanted, you know, the film doesn't have a traditional narrative. I'm not following one particular story for an hour and a half and sort of having digressions away from that. The film is sort of separated into five chapters that each deal with a handful of individuals, and each section sort of illuminates a different part of the industry. So you learn about the industry as you're learning these individual stories. And the way that I structured the film was to, essentially, I ended up sort of structuring the film around different species and how those different species are used in the laboratory and different stories about people who would have had those interactions and the individual animals themselves who would have been part of that as well. And the film essentially starts with discussing rats, and I often wonder if it would have worked better if I reversed everything. So I end the film with discussing Jerome, who was a chimpanzee, a well-known chimpanzee who was used in AIDS research. But I often wonder how it would have been if I would have started with Jerome and worked my way backwards. People are much more ready to give chimpanzees and macaque monkeys whatever you want to call it, a pass when it comes to their emotional lives and their psychological lives. We're willing to see, we're willing to see ourselves in them a bit more than we're willing to see ourselves in dogs or rats. But the film, basically, when it gets into discussing individuals, it starts with discussing Miss Peepers, who is a little rat that was saved from the University of Guelph, and she was used in nutritional testing. And it's not one of the things that I think her story really illustrates is that when we think of animal experimentation, we think of things as, you know, we think of that analogy of like your child or the dog kind of thing, you know, who would you rather, there was that Foundation for Biomedical Research had that billboard campaign, who would you rather die? That was actually the copy of the billboard. Who would you rather die? And on the one side, rather was separated rat, her, and it was the rat on one side and a little smiling young girl on the other, as if that's what we're talking about when we talk about vivisection. Mm-hmm. It's never really that.
That's,
but that's
a fundamental question.
Sure. And so Miss Peepers was used, though, in nutritional testing. So veterinary students would have these rats. I'm sure they were delivered. Well, actually, Erica Sullivan, who gives voice to Miss Peepers, discussed them as being Wistar rats. Wistar is a particular breed, and they come from a particular manufacturer who has been purpose breeding these rats for decades. And they're bred to have certain physical characteristics and traits that are useful in teaching. And Ms. Peepers was used. She was given a certain food at a certain time, and her little exercise wheel had a little counter on it. So the students would come in and record the values, and that was the way that they learned. Those results did not contribute anything further to human health outcomes. They didn't contribute anything further to rat health outcomes. They were literally just used to create a series of numbers that, that students could learn from. Arguably, they could have read those numbers out of a book or used a computer simulation or something like that. But at the end of that period where they were used, they would be euthanized. Euthanized is a nice word to describe what would happen to an animal that's killed for no other purpose than it's not useful anymore. But they would be euthanized at the end of that time. And Miss Peepers actually was the rat of one of Erica's friends who was taking this course. And so Erica adopted Miss Peepers and kept her in her residence, which was not allowed at the time, but she kept her there anyway. I was able to get this fantastic home video footage of Miss Peepers, and Erica describes the emotional attachment that she had and how they interacted with each other, and that she had favorite foods, and she had
personality.
And she had a personality. And in the next chapter, we meet Rita, who was a beagle who was used in breeding for one of the biggest dog breeders in Europe that breeds dogs for vivisection. And I mean, Rita is another story where, you know, she came from this absolutely wretched place, and through a lot of patience and through a lot of, in her story, it was a lot of courage of people who were willing to break the law to rescue her. She was able to have a new life. And I don't think many people who are listening need to be sold that dogs have rich emotional lives. I think we know that, but we seem to just be willing to set that aside. I mean, I think probably a lot of the general public doesn't know that dogs are so extensively used, but
do you think a film like this maybe makes it more difficult for people to set it aside?
I hope so. I mean, that's kind of the point of it. And I mean, the other point of it is that I really want people who are part of that industry who feel conflicted about what they're doing to reconsider things, whether it's trying to focus their work on non-animal models or whether it's to leave the industry altogether. And, you know, I think, speaking in generalities, we as a culture are willing to set aside the kind of things that happen in laboratories because we as a culture think that we're gaining something. We're gaining a lot from it. And the history of vivisection, I think, tells a different story. You know, yes, of course, we've learned things from animal experimentation. Dr. Ray Greek talks about the 9 different ways that animals are used in experiments. And we know really well that, I mean, you can grow a heart in a pig and implant that heart into a human and it works. You know, ethically, there's a whole bunch of other issues with that, but we know that scientifically that works. Whether or not animals predict human health outcomes is very up for debate. I mean, he's done research where he finds that the predictive value of animal experiments is less than 30%. That's not even as good as a coin toss. And we're willing, but we don't hear about those failures, right? Mm-hmm. We hear about the success stories, but we don't hear about the failures. And so the story that we have culturally about animal experimentation and what kind of good it does is very skewed towards the so-called victories. And we assume that because everything by law in North America, all medicines that reach the market have to be tested on animal models. They have to by law. Does that mean that testing on animals predicts the human outcomes? No, it doesn't. We could test all of the medication on rocks. That would just be the law. So I think there's a lot of sort of discourses and cultural stories at play when it comes to why we're willing to set that suffering aside and say it's a justifiable expense. But I mean, yeah, where do we go from there? I'm not sure.
Well, what about you? You were really close to this material for a long time. And I was told you before I was probably going to ask you how you get out of bed in the morning. When I interviewed Sean Monson about Earthlings, I guess I had a similar question to him about how do you day after day, not only did you do the investigative work, but you also then spent so much time with those images and really processing them. I think that sometimes people feel really powerless in the face of those that kind of egregious suffering on so many different levels, and the numbers, and then the lack of public dialogue about it. And I imagine that putting the film out has been empowering to some degree to feel like you're able to contribute to that cultural shift. But I'm wondering if you can take us through your own journey with these issues, which with a film like this, it's so complicated in terms of talking about psychology, talking about workers' perspectives. People watch it and they do feel that it's heavy. And so where do you go from that place?
It's a good question, and it's hard to answer it without feeling like, I mean, all animal rights activists tend to expose themselves to a lot of material like this. And I don't think that my pain in exposing myself to this kind of stuff day after day is necessarily unique. It might be a bit more acute for the time that I did it, but I mean, I feel like my experience is just a microcosm of what happens in our movement more generally. I think we continually traumatize ourselves to be able to remind ourselves of what goes on and why we fight. But I mean, I didn't deal with it well. I mean, like, you know, I was a wreck for a really long time, and it really put a strain on, you know, my own relationships and my psychology, and it wasn't a fun time for me. But yeah, I mean, editing the film pretty much from like February to July of 2012, I mean, I was waking up at 7 in the morning and working until the pot of coffee was gone at around noon, and then working again until, you know, I fell asleep. They were long days, and it was pretty much like 6 months straight of doing that. It was a rough time, and I don't really want to get into it again immediately. And so I'm trying to focus on doing some film work now that's a bit more fun. And you know, I'm playing a lot of music, and I listen to a lot of stand-up comedy, and like I just try and like take care of myself. I certainly haven't stepped away from the movement in that sense, but I'm obviously still promoting the film, and I'm watching it lots, and I'll be doing screenings all throughout the year. But yeah, you know, it's a long, the movement is going to be around for a long time, and I want to be a part of it and contribute to it hopefully more. And so I'm kind of taking a break from some of the more intensive animal stuff to keep myself afloat right now, and that's good. I mean, I'd really like to be able to sit here and be like, you know, I just did it because the animals need me, and like I did do it because the animals need us. But yeah, maybe next time I'll figure out a way to do it that maybe isn't 6 months straight of watching footage and editing it.
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying about I think a lot of people in this movement are constantly exposing themselves, but there's something about that repetition and the intimacy of really being close to it and over and over and over again, that exposure and that very focused kind of way that does seem incredibly difficult and really admirable that you did it.
Yeah, I mean, to maybe take it away from words like admirable and stuff too, like I think that, and I'm not trying to be falsely modest, but it also becomes mechanical to a certain degree. Like when you're editing, I love editing, and I've edited lots of different kinds of films, and I've edited lots of animal rights stuff for different groups, and it gets to a certain point. I mean, definitely first watching the footage is really difficult, but it gets to a point after months of working with it that the process becomes mechanical, and it becomes much more, like, to use a weird analogy, like it becomes much more clinical. It's like you're a scientist in a lab and you're saying, okay, there's just too many frames of this shot and I need two less frames. And it's like what's in the frame becomes
a technical project.
Yeah. It becomes more about the technical process and what, you know, the timing between shots and when to transition away from someone so that they're not blinking in the middle of a cut or something like that.
Right.
You know, there are those considerations that your emotional side just gets turned off and you're just going through like a robot being like, yeah, more frames, less frames, louder volume, you know.
So maybe it's both of those things at once in a way that it was really difficult thing to do. And then on the other hand, there was a certain level of detachment or dissociation that you do in order to complete.
Yeah. And it's the same with investigative work too. I mean, you have to dissociate yourself from what's going on. I mean, not only to get the material that you're getting, but to get out of the situation safely, you need to just be who you say you're being, and you can't concern yourself with what's happening in front of you.
One of the things that is so powerful within the film as well, and it's sort of is touching on some of the themes that you just mentioned about struggling or sitting with these images or these issues, is that in the film, we meet workers who in many ways seem deeply conflicted and people who are really in the midst of struggling, and we get to kind of look into that struggle. I mean, it's the things that they're saying, but even just the expressions on people's faces. What was it like to talk with these people who had been part of this industry? For the most part, they had already stepped away from it, but you did speak with one person who was still in the midst of being part of the industry. These are people that were having a hard time, it seemed, with what they had done.
Yeah, so most of the people in the film had already transitioned out of the industry and were either still working in the industry, although working in a different non-animal framework, or were doing, you know, working in some other area that didn't involve animal experimentation. But then there were people who were part of that work, but then totally stepped away. And there was, as you mentioned, one of the people who's in the film was still in the industry when I interviewed him, and he contacted me through one of the other folks in the film, and basically her name is Rachel, and she contacted me and said, there's this guy, he just got in touch with me about what he's going through. She runs this kind of online support group for current and former lab workers. So she sent him to me and said, you know, maybe you want to tell him your story or whatever. So we started an email exchange, and, you know, people have asked me if it was hard to be able to like face them and to hear their stories. And I think somebody even asked me, like, how did you not hate them? And like, I see myself in them as much as I don't want to, you know, and they struggled. They're like everyone else in the world. They're struggling to be able to live with themselves at the end of the day. And, you know, what an amazing opportunity to have someone who's still in the research industry come to me as an animal rights activist and as a filmmaker, but as an animal rights activist. I mean, I made that really clear to him up front that that was my position. How lucky am I to have someone like him come to me and one, not only want to tell me his story, but two, ask me for support in changing what he was doing and what he was a part of. I felt a real obligation to him too, because he had confided in me that he had no one else to talk to. He didn't feel like he could talk to his family. He didn't feel like he could talk. He certainly didn't feel like he could talk to anybody that he worked with. And I think about what would have happened if I would have turned him away. Like, if I would have said, you're a horrible person and see you later. I mean, not only would the film have lost an important voice, but I feel like he would have lost an important moment where he realized that nobody was looking out for him. And yeah, I felt a great sense of obligation to be able to be that support for him. And I'm so thrilled about where his life is at now. And he quit his job. He took a month leave knowing full well that he would likely quit afterwards. And he did. And it was really difficult, but he had had this dream for a long time of starting his own microbrewery. And now he's like doing that and learning about it. And I mean, his life has just had this incredible turn. And I don't want to take credit for it. I mean, I would like to think that if I wasn't there, there would have been another activist there who would have, you know, been a shoulder to have him tell their story and to hear it without judgment so that he could get it out and be able to work through it. I mean, I do carry a sense of anger towards the industry in the abstract, like the industry, quote unquote. I have a great sense of anger towards what it is and what it represents. But I really find it hard to muster hatred towards particular individuals, really ever, but in particular with people who, I mean, they trusted me with their stories. It would be so awful for me to cast judgment upon them after establishing that trust. Like, I consider them my friends now.
I think this leads to hopefully a productive question about who you want to see the film. It ends with, instead of, we had talked about this before, instead of the inconvenient truth kind of change your light bulbs to compact fluorescence, there isn't a series of things that you're necessarily the kind of takeaway, now you can go home and do this for activists who are watching it. But it's actually, it ends with, there's resources, but it's outreach to workers. You really seem to want workers to see this film.
Yeah, I really do. And time will tell how successful that is. And you know, I plan on making the film very readily available to universities in all kinds of faculties to be able to be watched. And yeah, I mean, I didn't want to do that whole inconvenient truth montage at the end with like, you know, buy this or do that. One, because like we talked about before, it's not really a consumer-driven industry in the same way. But two, because, well, to be honest, I just don't think that's good filmmaking. I think it's kind of tacky and doesn't really give the audience enough credit to know what's going to be useful in their own communities. It would be really ridiculous of me to give like a prescriptive, here's what you can do, because I don't know what's happening on the other side of the province, really. Like, I know what's happening in Toronto. I know a little bit about what's happening in a few other cities, but it would be silly of me to say, to give people advice about what kind of activism to do when I don't know what the situation is like on the ground there, wherever they are.
But that building of the bridge to workers seems really important. And
absolutely,
something that you did feel that you wanted to direct this story to them, or to have them be able to access these resources or to know that they exist.
Yep. And I also wanted, I mean, that was how I came into animal rights activism, you know, like being involved with the show and seeing the kind of work that you were doing with the show when I originally got involved. I mean, that has informed how I've done my activism and it's informed my thinking about animal issues since then. Of course, I'm going to value workers' perspectives. That's such a valuable perspective to take into account. And so those title cards at the end where I give people contact information where lab workers and researchers can reach out, I want them to see that. But I also want animal rights activists to see that because, you know, we talk a lot about building bridges and building coalitions, and that kind of work is, I think it's really important. And that, I think that also includes making an effort to build bridges with people who are in that archetypal way, like our greatest enemies, in that like way that we think about the struggle. These folks, especially the folks who are sort of on the fence about things, I think we have so much to learn and so much to gain from building bridges with them. And I think they're really going to be at the forefront of the cultural shift that needs to happen for animal experimentation to eventually be phased out. we're not going to stop all animal experimentation by shopping at certain stores. I mean, I like shopping at Lush too, and I think they do great stuff. But they also recognize, I mean, through the prizes that they gave out this year, they also recognize that the fight against animal testing has to take place in a number of different categories, and it has to be able to take into account people who are working on alternatives, people who are working on, you know, discussing the ethical implications, people who are talking about on-the-ground activism and outreach. It's going to have to encompass all of those things, because just withholding our money from the research industry isn't possible. The money comes from lots of different places. And yeah, so I really did want activists to see that I'm willing to build that bridge, and that I'm willing to listen to these stories and to present these stories in an empathetic way. I hope it gives people pause for thought. I'm not really interested in telling activists what to do, but I hope that they look at it and it challenges them a little bit as much as it challenged me. It was really challenging to hear what people were saying and where they came from, and to be able to see them as not characters. And I mean, that to me is like the big takeaway from producing the film, is like, nobody goes to sleep at night and thinks they're a monster. Everybody tells themselves a story that makes them a good person, or they try and tell themselves a story that makes them a good person. And I do the same thing, and we all do. I think it's just so ridiculous for us to think that, like, there's one or two, but like, really, I don't think the vivisection industry is populated by a bunch of mad scientists who are going, yeah, I can't wait to abuse animals. Yeah. Like, it's just ridiculous for us to imagine that. And it's really disingenuous for us to present our activism like that.
Thank you so much for being here, Carl.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, Dan, for checking.
Thank you.
So we have less than a minute, probably. I want to let people know you can go to MaximumToleratedDose.org if you want more information. Is there any other resources you want to give people?
People can definitely check out the BUAV, the British Union for the Abolition of Vivisection. You can go to www.buav.org. They've really been at the forefront of doing investigative work for the last couple decades, and their work has really blown the industry wide open, so I do encourage people to check their stuff out.
And I would also just say as a final point that when we did the screening in Kingston, people said that it was a beautiful film, which seems somewhat strange to say, but really is aesthetically incredible, even if you're not necessarily someone who is interested in animal issues, which I assume people here listening to Animal Voices are, but it's if you're interested in workers' perspectives, just good documentary filmmaking, storytelling, this is definitely a film you'll want to check out. Thanks for listening to Animal Voices. Please stay tuned and check us out next week.